109.
So I want to go through a little of the story of Eliezer finding a wife for Yitzchak. It's a very long story. The chapter is, I don't know, about 60 or 70 verses, 67 verses. I don't want to go through the whole thing. I just want to kind of focus on a few parts of the story. But this story is Eliezer's attempt to find a wife for Yitzchak. This is where he finds Rivka and decides she's the right one to come marry Yitzchak. So let's begin in the beginning. I want to go through quickly Avraham's mission given to Eliezer, and then we'll discuss what he actually did. So on page 109. Now Avraham was old, well on in years, and Hashem had blessed Avraham with everything. So Avraham had reached a point where he performed the Akedah. He had lived a very full, successful life, doing Hashem's bidding in this world. And he had everything, it says. He had everything he needed. The one thing he was missing, though, was a wife for his son. That's one thing he was missing. And Avraham said to his servant, the elder of his household, who controlled all that was his, place now your hand under my thigh. So what does he want to do over here? So he wants to marry off his son in his lifetime. Avraham had reached a point he was too old to go himself. He didn't want to go and schlep out to a different country and look for a wife, so he wanted to send his servant. There were no lack of girls who wanted to marry Avraham's family. I mean, Avraham, it says, had everything. I mean, he had wealth, he had fame, he was a good, honest, upstanding individual. I mean, there are plenty of girls who wanted to marry into this family. But Avraham said, I can't have just any girl marry Yitzchak. Yitzchak is somebody who is on a very high spiritual plane. I need to find the right girl, the proper girl to join my family. So he calls Eliezer in and makes him take an oath. When it says that he should put his hand under my thigh, what it refers to is the following. For when a real oath is done, halachically, similar to what you see even nowadays, let's say even in a non-Jewish courtroom, they put their hand on a mitzvah item. So like nowadays, they'll swear on a Bible in a non-Jewish courtroom. But even in halacha, there's an idea of grabbing a mitzvah item to swear. Now what mitzvah did Avraham have? Avraham had his bris. That was his mitzvah he had. So he says, put your hand on my leg. That's as if you're grabbing onto a mitzvah item, and you can swear based on that. So that's why he told him, grab onto my thigh. Now, Eliezer...
Is that the euphemism for...
To his body parts, right. But, I mean, I don't know if he grabbed that part directly, but I mean, the point is that it was around that part to show there was a mitzvah item he was grabbing, correct?
To take an oath.
Yeah, to take his oath. So so this was a real powerful oath. And the idea of the oath was the following. I mean, you can ask the question, Eliezer was a loyal servant to Avraham, so he could trust him to do his bidding. Why did he have to make him swear to go ahead and do this mission? Why was an oath involved? So commentaries explain, number one, Avraham was concerned that somebody might offer Eliezer lots of money to get the opportunity to marry Yitzchak. I mean, again, this was quite a prestigious family to marry into. So even Eliezer, who was loyal, it could be bribed. It's a possibility. As loyal as he is, you know, enough money might persuade him otherwise. Also, Avraham was concerned that he might die before the mission is completed. So he wanted to be sure that this mission will be carried on no matter what. I mean, in my lifetime, I understand that I can trust you. But after my death, maybe you won't go ahead and complete the mission. So I want you to swear right now so that I know it will be carried out regardless. So two reasons why he made him take an oath. But ultimately, he took this oath and he told him the following. Look at verse 3. And I'll have you swear by Hashem, God of heaven and the God of earth, that you not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Rather to my land and my kindred shall you go and take a wife for my son for Isaac. So what is the oath? The oath is, I don't want you to marry him off to any Canaanite woman. You have to go back to my homeland and find a wife from amongst my homeland. When it says here in the English, kindred, or in the Hebrew, it's molanti. So it's disputed if it means from my family or just from like my hometown. So some say it just means a girl from my hometown, and some say he actually met his family. And we'll talk more about that later. But that is the oath that Eliezer has to take. And the point is that Avraham wanted to be sure that this was carried out, and he did not want Yitzchak marrying a Canaanite girl. He felt the Canaanite girls, as we'll speak about more, were immoral. They lacked the midos needed to marry into Avraham's family. And therefore he said, don't take a little girl from the local land of Canaan, go to my homeland and take a girl from there. Now Rav Hirsch points out that they're all idolaters anyways, meaning Avraham was a monotheist, he believed in Hashem. But people in Canaan, people back in his homeland, were all idolaters. So why is it so different? And the answer is that because even though religiously they were idolaters, but the people back in his homeland were more moral, more ethical, more upright, honest people. They had better midos. And the people in Eretz Canaan, in the land of Canaan, were immoral and less ethical. So he understood, okay, we're going to find an idolater because that's who's out there. But that can change. But if their midos are not in the right place, then I can't have the woman enter my family. Now, Rav Hirsch says that moral degeneration gets a grip on the whole nature of a person. So if they're morally degenerate, then it's going to be very difficult to bring them into Avram's family. If they're morally upright, but yet they serve idols, that we can work with. That was Avraham's goal over here, is to find a girl with proper midos. So he takes this oath. Look, continue in verse 5. The servant said to him, "Perhaps the woman shall not wish to follow me to this land. Shall take your son back to the land from which you departed?" So Eliezer says, "Okay, so I'll go to the land and I'll find a great girl, but she'll say, 'I don't want to live in Canaan. I want to stay here.' So shall I bring Yitzchak back to your homeland, to the land of Aram Naharaim?" So Avram answered him, "Beware not to return to my son to there. Hashem, God of heaven, who took me from the house of my father and from the land of my birth, who spoke concerning me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there." So he made Eliezer promise not to take Yitzchak out of the land of Canaan, or to Israel. He had to stay there. Now, it's very interesting. It's pointed out, now Yitzchak is not involved in this conversation at all. You think if you're finding him a wife, he was a grown man, Yitzchak. He wasn't like a little kid. If you're finding him a wife, maybe he should be the one taking the initiative. He should be involved. He should have some say in the matter. But he's totally not involved. Additionally, Avram is saying, by no means can he leave the land of Israel, the land of Canaan. He has to stay here no matter what. And the commentaries struggle with the fact, why is he so out of the picture? And we'll mention in short, and this could be a longer discussion at some other point, that Yitzchak, after the Akedah, he's regarded as this like holy sacrifice. I mean, even though he wasn't actually killed and slaughtered and burnt on the Mizbeach, the rest of his life, he was like living in like some other world, like a different plane. Like he's somebody whose head was really just in the heavens, in the spiritual, and very not in the physical. So Yitzchak, he remains kind of passive in the sense that he doesn't say, "I need to go find a wife." His father takes care of it for him. He's never allowed to leave the land of Israel. He's not allowed to. Here Avram says, "Don't do it," and Hashem later tells him he can't do it. He was like a holy individual, kind of living above this world, and therefore he kind of stepped back from any matters of this world.
He wasn't like that before the Akedah?
Seemingly not. I mean, we don't have any record of that in the Torah anywhere. I mean, the point is, at the Akedah, he is called an Olot Tmima. He's a perfect sacrifice, and that remained with him the rest of his life, that status. So he kind of did live on a different plane after the Akedah. So Avram says that you can't take Yitzchak back from this to any other country. Leave him here in Eretz Canaan, and he tells him he will send an angel before you. I mean, Hashem will take care of you. Don't worry, Hashem is going to guide you, Eliezer. He's going to make sure you find the right wife. But if the woman will not wish to follow you, this is verse 8, you shall then be absolved of this oath of mine. However, do not return my son to there. Meaning, if you can't find a girl there, then okay, then you did your best, but you can't take my son out of this land. So that was the bottom line. Yitzchak stays near Tisrael. Wife or not. If you can find a wife to come back here, then wonderful. And if not, then so be, we'll figure something else out. Rashi says, well, if you can't find a wife there, I can turn to my friends here in Eretz Canaan. He had three friends that are mentioned in the Chumash: Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. Those names are mentioned a few parshas back.
Avraham had friends,
yeah. They were the friends he consulted with before he had a bris milah. He spent some time in their land, Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. So he said, they have daughters also. So if I can't find a girl from my homeland, I do have people here I can go to and feel comfortable with. That's what he told Eliezer. Very interesting plan B, as it were. There's one distinction to point out in these verses. In verse 3, Abraham refers to Hashem as the God of heaven and the God of earth. In verse 7, he calls him the God of heaven. So why did he leave out the term God of earth in verse 7 and used it in verse 3? So Rashi says, well, in verse 7, if you look at the context, Avram there is speaking about his past. He's saying, Hashem, God of heaven, took me from the house of my father and from the land of my birth, and etc., and he brought me here. So he's referring to his past experiences where he was back in his homeland before Lech Lecha, and Hashem told him, leave your land and go to the land of Canaan. In verse 3, he's referring to Hashem in the present. I mean, right now, he is my God, who's the God of heaven, the God of earth. So what changed? So Rashi says, well, it's very simple. When Avraham was younger, in his early years, Hashem's name was not known in the world. I mean, Avraham's entire life, he was there promoting God in the world. So at that point, he was the God of heaven, but he wasn't known as the God of earth. In the earth, they were serving idols. No, they were pagans. But yet, now, Avraham, you know, fast forward 60, 70 years, so now Avraham has accomplished that God's name is a household word. Everyone in the world is aware of this God of Avraham, and therefore now he's referred to as the God of earth. So Avraham did an amazing thing, which is that he succeeded in bringing God's name into the world. That really was his role, and that was the beginning of the Jewish people, was that there should be a nation in this world that allows God to be recognized and noticed, you know, in daily life. So Avraham succeeded in doing that, and it's clear, but he began as the God of the heavens, and then he ended up as the God of heaven and the God of earth, because Avraham was able to make that transition, that he should be recognized as the God of the earth as well. So that is the mission given to Eliezer. So Avraham doesn't give him any specifics. He basically says, find a girl in my homeland. And she has to come back here. He can't go there. Doesn't say, you know, what should she look like? What should she talk like? You know, what personality should she have? Those are not part of the discussion. We're going to see Eliezer, in his own wisdom, is going to devise a test to find the right girl. But Avraham doesn't give him that much of a resume to look for. Avraham just says, go find a girl. You know, make sure she's from the homeland and comes back here to the land of Canaan. So Eliezer takes the oath, verse 9. So the servant places his hand under the thigh of Avraham. So he grabbed on to the mitzvah item, as we said, to make the oath, and swore him regarding this matter. Okay, so he made the oath. Verse 10. And the servant took 10 camels of his master's camels and set out with all the bounty of his master in his hand and made his way to Aram Naharaim, the city of Nahor. So he goes back to Avram's homeland, Aram Naharaim, and to the city of Nahor, which was where Avram's family was. It says they took 10 camels and he took all the bounty of his master. So what does it mean, all the bounty? I mean, to take all of Avraham's possessions would have been a little bit overwhelming. Avraham was a wealthy man. He only took 10 camels. He didn't take all of his camels. He didn't take all of his sheep. He didn't take everything he owned. So what does it mean he took all of his master's bounty? In the Hebrew it says, kol tuva donav, all of the good of his master. So Rashi says what he took was actually a contract that said, I'm giving all of my property to Yitzchak. He didn't carry the property with him. He carried with him a contract so he could show the family, look, you know, Yitzchak's going to be a wealthy man. I have a contract right here from his father that all is going to go to him. So like, I guess like a will. So that's the way Rashi explains it. Rabbeinu Bechaya, a different commentary, he says that the Eliezer, when it says he took all of his master's bounty, it doesn't mean he carried the bounty. What it means is that he was in control of all of Avram's wealth. Meaning it was speaking, this is a adjective describing Eliezer's power in Avram's household. So it wasn't that he carried it with him, but he had control over all of it. And the Sforno says, it doesn't mean he took everything, it means he took a display of wealth. He wanted to display a little of Avram's wealth. So it was like a little bit of a glimpse of all of Avram's bounty. But to take this literally, see, he carried everything with him, obviously would be impossible, especially on just 10 camels. I assume he would need hundreds of thousands of camels to bring everything with him. And that'd be silly. Why would he bring everything with him anyways? So the point was, he's trying to show that Avraham was a wealthy man. If you marry this family, you're going to have a lot coming to you. That was why he took it with him. It says he took his master's camels. And Rashi points out that these camels were known to be Avraham's camels. I mean, it doesn't just say in the verse he took 10 camels. It says he took 10 camels of his master's camels. So Rashi says, why were Avraham's camels so unique? Rashi says because they were always muzzled, because Avraham was very sensitive that they shouldn't eat of anybody else's pastures. Mm-hmm. So Avraham's camels were known in the world. Avraham is careful with what he does. Avraham does not allow his camels even to be unmuzzled at any moment, lest they might steal one blade of grass from somebody else. So his camels were known that way. And it's a very important lesson for us, that people recognized Avraham and really all the Avos Imahos in the bigger picture as people not just that had great ideals, but carried them out in real life. Avraham preached honesty and kindness, etc., and being upright and being moral. He just preached it. He did it. And everyone knew, okay, that's Avraham's camel there, because look, there's a muzzle on his mouth. And therefore, Avraham's being extra careful with theft. So Eliezer took that with him as well. And he was it's two things. He was displaying the wealth of Avraham, but also displaying how honest Avraham was. This wealth was fully honest. Every single penny he had came through honest dealings. And even his camels were a known sight, that Avraham's camels are going to be the ones who don't eat from anyone else's pastures. So that is verse 10. Verse 11. He made the camels kneel down outside the city towards a well of water at evening time, the time when women came out to draw. Okay, so it was the evening now, and it was the custom that women would come out to draw water at that time. So now he goes to the well, and the well is the place where all these biblical shidduchim are always made. Now, they always seem to find girls at the well. Moshe did it, and Eliezer does it, and Yaakov does it. Everyone seems to find their spouse at the well. So verse 12. So Eliezer now, he is a true student of Avraham. So if you're Avraham's student, what do? You daven. The first thing he does is he prays to Hashem. And he says, let's read the prayer. He said, Hashem, God of my master Avraham, may you so arrange it for me this day that you do kindness with my master Avraham. So the first thing he does is he davens. And he says that I need you, Hashem, to guide me. See, I stand here by the spring of water, and the daughters of the townsmen come out to draw. Let it be the maiden to whom I shall say, please tip over your jug so I may drink. And he replies, drink. And I'll even water your camels. Her will you have designated for your servant, for Isaac. May I know through her that you have done kindness with my master. So Eliezer davens, but he doesn't just daven. He does a few things here. First he says, Hashem, I need your help. I need you to arrange for me that I find the right girl. The Hebrew term here used is hakre no lefanai. The word hakre comes from the word mikra. Mikra usually means like a coincidence, like a happenstance. And when you daven for a happenstance to occur, that's kind of an oxymoron in a certain sense. You know, if you daven it should happen, it's planned out. If it just happens, then it's not planned out. It's just a coincidence. So when Eliezer says, hakre lo fanai, let it just happen before me. So the idea is that in the eyes of someone like Eliezer, in the eyes of a true tzaddik, they understand that even things that are just coincidences are planned out by God. There's no such thing as just mikra. Nothing just happens. Everything is part of God's plan. So he even says, it will seem like coincidence. I happen to be here at the right time, in the right place, the right girl walks in. But I understand, Hashem, you're the one who actually makes the coincidence actually occur. It's not only happenstance, it's your plan. So davens, Hashem, make this plan happen before me. Help me see that you are guiding me to find the right girl for Yitzchak. In his prayer, he twice mentions the term chesed, kindness. He says, number one, he says, arrange for me this day that you do kindness with my master Avraham. And then in verse 14, he says, and may I know through her that you have done kindness. So he invokes the term chesed twice. And commentaries explain, because Avraham, we know, was somebody who stood for chesed. So as Avraham's student, so he always invokes the idea of chesed to Hashem, because he knows that this is Avraham's hallmark. Avraham's all about chesed. So he speaks a lot about chesed. And ultimately, what's he looking for in this girl? He's looking for chesed. He knew what the house of Avraham was all about. He understood Avraham was someone who stood for kindness, for chesed, for compassion for others. So to find the right girl to marry in, she must have that trait of chesed. So he devises a test. And it's important that this test was not given to Avraham. This is Eliezer's personal understanding of what's needed for Yitzchak. And he was right. But what was the test? So the test was, he's going to see a girl and tell her, please tip over your jug so I may drink. So he's going to ask for water. And the girl is going to reply, drink, and I'll even water your camels. So that's the test. How will she respond to the request for drinking? That's what's going to be asked. So what was he looking for? So number one, it's not just doing what's asked. If you do what you're asked, then that's just, you know, that's just kind of being polite. If you ask me and I tell you no, that's like rude. If you ask me and I say, okay, so you can't say I'm this tremendous Baal Chesed, full compassion. I'm being a polite person. A stranger is tired, comes to ask me for help, I'll help him out. But if you go above the call of duty, meaning he says, I'm going to ask for water for myself. If she then goes ahead and also gives water to the camels, that means that she's going beyond just the typical, you know, being polite. She actually cares. She's sensitive to my needs. And that's a true balas chesed. She's recognizing the needs beyond the call of duty. When you want to know, is somebody truly a lover of kindness, lover of chesed? It's not about what they do. It's about if they love it, if they're compassionate, if they're passionate about it. So many people might do something kind, but it doesn't mean they are kind on the inside. They do it because it's expected. They feel bad not to. They don't want to be rude. They want to be polite. But if you're going above and beyond for chesed, you're taking initiative, you're seeing deeper in the situation and doing it, it shows that there's a deeper meat of chesed within. That you are driven as a kind person. You're not just doing nice things. There's a big difference between the two. He wanted a balas chesed, someone who is endowed with the meat of chesed, rather than someone who just does nice things. It's not just being polite, but it's true chesed. Now, really, commentaries point out, she could have said, well, wait a minute. No, you're a wealthy man. I see all your wealth here. Where's your servants? Why are they doing it for you? Right? The chutzpah, you ask me? I'm this nice young girl. You ask me to draw water for you? She could have said that. But she looks beyond that. She understands that if he's asking, he must need it. It's not up to me to judge him why he's asking. He's a strong servant, and she's this, you know, this little girl. But ultimately, if he asks, and she can see beyond, then she helps. You know, it's reminiscent of a famous story which you maybe heard before. The story, I think they say in the name of the Brisker Rav, that someone came to him before Pesach and asked, are you allowed to drink milk for your 4 cups of wine? He's milk instead. And he said, the halacha is you're not allowed to, and gave her a very hefty donation. So his wife asked him, why'd you give her so much money? Meaning, so give her money for wine. Why'd you give her some bottles of wine? Why are you giving her so much money? He said, well, if she's asking about milk for her Seder, that means she can't afford meat, because you can't have your milk with your meat. So obviously she needs more than just wine. She needs meat as well for her Seder, and give her the meat, give her money for meat too. But it seemed beyond the situation. You don't just say, okay, what's the request? Okay, I need wine. Here's wine. You say, well, let me figure out what you really need. I see you're asking for water, but you have 10 camels here. And if you can't even draw your own water, what about your camels? You didn't ask for it, but if I can read the situation, I can see the person's actual needs and then act upon the needs, not just on what I'm requested to do. So it's a very similar point. You know, he didn't just say, okay, you're asking about milk, here's some wine. He said, well, if you're asking about milk, there's more than meets the eye over here. You need something more than milk. You need meat. You need a whole Seder. You probably can't afford to have a nice meal because you're asking this question. So Eliezer was looking for someone who really went beyond the call of duty.
Why?
He also said, it says here, let me just find the language, it says, I'm going to be standing. I stand here by the spring of water. So she could have said, well, you're just standing around. Just do something. Help out. Like, again, it's always this, it's not judging the person, but it's seeing his needs. It says this is a time where all the ladies came to draw water. So the commentaries point out the following point. You have to look at the words a little bit. It says that he's going to tell her, please tip over your jug so I may drink. Now, if you picture it, yeah, none of us really have experienced drawing water, I don't think, at a well. But if you picture it, if the jug is being tipped over, it means it's already on her shoulder. So she'd already drawn the water, put it on her shoulder, and he's asking her to from her shoulder, to give him water. That's difficult to do. There are other girls currently coming to draw more water who had their jugs on the floor. So she could have said, don't ask me. I already have my jug on my shoulder ready to go home. Ask that girl over there who just put it on the floor. Let her give you a little water. It's much easier for her. But again, if you ask me to do you the chesed, I don't want to refuse it. And if she says, I'll do it, that shows, again, her appreciation of chesed or sensitivity. Because it's a lot of work to have to take down a jug of water off your shoulders. Take somebody else. Also, when she says, I want to feed the camels, so that means she says, if you need help, most of your camels need help too. It's all just being seen the situation for what it is and being sensitive to it. So let's see what happens. Verse 15. And it was when he had not yet finished speaking. So when a tzaddik davens, Hashem might respond before he even finishes davening. I mean, he didn't finish the tefillah yet. He's still in the middle of his prayers. And before he even finishes, suddenly Rebecca was coming out. So Rivka starts to approach the well. She who had been born to Besuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, brother of Avraham, with her jug upon her shoulder. So Rivka was there. The word that says suddenly, in Hebrew the word is hine. That means it was like a surprise, like it wasn't expected. So what do you mean she suddenly came? I mean, she was coming to the well. What do you mean she suddenly came? So the Malbim says that Rivka actually never before in her life came to the well. This is her first time coming to draw water. It wasn't expected. Her family's a wealthy family. They had servants who could draw water. The fact that this young girl was coming to draw water was out of the ordinary. It wasn't expected. But this is all part of the of Hashem's hashkacha. Hashem was setting up the situation so that Eliezer would meet Rivka. But it wasn't something expected. And then this all happened before he even finished his prayers. He was in the middle of davening, And we say in Shemon Esrei on fast days. It says Vayaterem Yikrav Ani Ene. Now before you even call out, I can answer you. Odhim Adabrim, you're still speaking. Vanyeshma, I hear you. Meaning when someone davens sincerely, Hashem will respond before you even finish. It's like the instant response. So out comes Rivka suddenly, in an unexpected way. And it says in verse 16, now the maiden was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She ascended to the spring and filled her jug and ascended. So he is watching this, and he sees this good-looking young girl, and she goes and fills her jug at the spring. Now it says that in verse 17, the servant ran to her. So how did it go to her? I mean, she wasn't the only girl there. There are many girls there. This was the time, as it said in earlier on, that all the girls would come out to draw water. So how did he pinpoint Rivka? He could have gone to 10 other girls first. I mean, it was his lucky day. He chose the right girl right away. Where did that come from? So the Nitziv says the following 3 points. He says there's 3 things that the verses are pointing out that drew Eliezer to Rivka. Number one, it says that she was beautiful. So he was looking for a beautiful girl. She's beautiful. Very fair to look upon. Number two, it says the men had not known her. Meaning she acted in a modest way. She didn't hang out with all the men. I mean, the other girls that came down, they were mingling with the men, talking to the men. She kind of stayed alone in a modest way. And number three, it says that she descended to the spring to fill her jug and then ascended. I mean, a lot of the girls would bend over in a way that wasn't so becoming, wasn't so modest. They would just kind of bend over, reach in and pull out. She actually walked into the spring to pull the water out, so she didn't have to bend over in an immodest way. So he saw her modesty. He saw that she did not mingle with the men, and he saw that she was beautiful. So he said, that's a good candidate. He didn't know, but he said that girl looks like she might fit into Avram's family. Because I see her standards of modesty would fit, and I see she's a beautiful woman, so we'll see what we can do. But that drew him to at least go and approach Rivka and do the test. So then he runs to her, meaning when he sees her, he runs because he saw the potential. Once he saw the potential, he ran to it. He saw, this could be it. It could be I can fulfill my mission. And he says, let me sip, if you please, a little water from your jug. So he asked for a little bit of water. Now Rav Hirsch points out, the verse says the servant ran to her. Meaning it was clear he was a servant. So if you could picture this, she's a girl from a wealthy family. This guy is a servant. And he clearly appeared like a servant. So she still treated him with respect and dignity and helped him out. She could have said, you're a slave. Go help yourself. But she didn't say that. In verse 18, she said, drink my lord. She actually calls him my lord, even though he was a slave. And she could have disparaged him and put him down. And he acted like a slave. But she responded with honor in a dignified way. Please drink my lord. And quickly she lowered her jug to her hand and gave him a drink. She took it off her shoulder, lowered it down, and gave him the drink. So she actually fulfilled, so far, she did every single point of the test. We didn't get to the camels yet. But so far, we see beyond his test, she approached him with dignity and with respect, despite the fact he was a servant. She immediately said, I'm happy to give you water, took it off her shoulder, and gave him the drink. One commentary even says, when it says gave him the drink, it means she actually poured it into his mouth directly. Didn't have to make him come and get his own water. She actually poured it right where he wanted it. So that was the, so far she's doing pretty good. But she didn't offer the camels yet. Now in verse 19, when she finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water even for your camels until they finish drinking. So now she offers the camels too. Now why did she wait until now to offer the camels? I mean, she could have said initially, I'm going to give to you and your camels. But she gave to him, let him finish drinking, then gave to the camels. So really there's 2 points he made over here. Number one is if I group you with the camels, that puts you down. I'll give you and your camels. You're a camel also. Now she didn't want him to feel that way. That I group you along the animals. Number two, if she said to him first, I'm going to give you and the camels, he'll feel bad that she's going to be burdened with so much water to draw. He might hold back on what he's drinking. Meaning when you do a chesed, just make sure the person feels good about receiving the chesed. So if she says, I'm going to give you a drink, he'll say, okay, and he drinks what he wants. If she says, I'm going to give you and your camels, he'll take a sip and he'll feel bad, because I'm going to drink, then you have to go and draw more for the camels. I'm not going to drink so much, so you don't have to do as much work. And he'll feel bad about it. So she was very sensitive to that, and she did not offer the camels until he drank himself. But then she goes and she gets water for the camels. So she hurried and emptied her jug into the trough, and kept running to the well to draw water, and she drew for all the camels. So she emptied out her jug into the trough, meaning she didn't save that water for the camels. And some commentators explain because it would also be an insult to Eliezer that the water I drink, you give to the camels, like we drink the same water. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to make sure that the water for the camels was separate. But she poured it into the trough because she didn't want to waste it. She didn't just dump it onto the ground or something. She wanted to be sure she used it properly. So poured it into the trough, went to get new water for the camels. And we see here that she runs. She doesn't just walk down normally, she hurries. And this fits Avraham. Avraham, we know, when he did the chesed, he hurried into the chesed. In the Vayera, when he's going to give his guests food and drink, the Torah constantly stresses him running around quickly. So Rivka also, when she does the chesed, she fits Avram's family. She rushes to the chesed. She hurries to empty the jug, and she kept running to the well. She's running to make sure that everything is taken care of. And she drew water for all her camels. So Rivka is passing this test with flying colors. She really is. I want to read you just a quote from Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch always just says things in a very beautiful way. So I'll read you how he explains this whole incident. Rav Hirsch says, she answers, drink, and adds, my lord, although he stands as a slave before her, as we pointed out, and then promptly, step by step, disclosed the woman who was worthy with her Abrahamitic feelings to take the place of Sarah. So we're seeing a woman who can actually step into Sarah's shoes. Why? Because at first, not a word about the camels, as Eliezer had hoped. I mean, Eliezer at first, he may have been a little bit doubtful because she didn't offer water to the camels. Only when she had completely quenched the thirst of Eliezer did she say, for your camels too I will fill water. Had Rebecca said this at once, a certain trait which characterizes the true Gomelas Chesed, a true Jewish woman, would have been missing. She would have been a conceited gossip who likes to make big talk about her good deeds. Then she does not offer merely to give the camels also a drink. I mean, she doesn't want to talk about it. When I do it, I'll talk about it. I mean, I'm not a big talker. I'll give you water. When I give the camels, I'll give the camels. But I don't have to like tell you, I'm going to give the camels also, because I'm so special. That by itself would already be quite a tiresome task. Just to give each camel a jug full would entail 10 journeys down to the well, and 10 drawings up of the bucket, because there's 10 camels there. But no, she will draw and fill the whole trough up until all the camels have drunk their fill. A camel drinks enough at a time to enable it to go for 3 days without water. Perhaps it gets its name Gomel from that fact. I mean, the word Gomel could be like to bear a load. And with it, all how nimble and quick she is. It says that she rushed, she hurried, she does not think long about it, and is not slow or dilatory when it is a matter of doing humane work. So she doing a tremendous amount of work and is happy to do it and rushes to do it. And what Eliezer left in the pitcher, she carefully empties into the trough. She could have left it in or thrown it out on the floor, but the Jewish nature is as economical with its forces and means as is extravagant with them. I mean, he says a very, very interesting point. He says that Jews, you know, we're known to be, the stereotype is Jews are cheap, right? So he says we're economical, but also extravagant, meaning that the tiniest means for doing a mitzvah is fulfilling a duty, and everything is holy to it. So we're not going to waste anything uselessly. Even the smallest expenditure of energy or a tiny drop of water, we're not going to waste. But when it's for a good purpose, it knows no limits to what we will spend of our forces and our means. So a Jew, yes, we don't want to waste anything for no reason, but when it comes to doing a mitzvah, we're going to spend it all. And that really should be the Jewish attitude. So Sarifka as well didn't want to waste any water from his jugs when it came to wasting. But in terms of doing the chesed, she would do as much as possible. She would never stop. As much water, as much time, as much energy is needed, I will make sure it gets done. So Rivka really does an amazing job at passing the test. Look at verse 21. The man was astonished at her, reflecting silently to know whether Hashem had made his journey successful or not. So Eliezer remained silent. He was watching. He was contemplative. It's very interesting. He didn't talk to her. I mean, we don't find him talking to her at all. You might think part of finding a good shidduch is like the conversation. Maybe we should figure out who this girl is. But the answer is actions speak louder than words. He didn't say anything to her. Her actions spoke so loud, the conversation was not necessary. I see through her actions, through her response, that she is the right woman. So what happens in verse 22? And it was when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a golden nose ring. Its weight was a beka, that's a certain weight, and 2 bracelets on her arms. 10 gold shekels was her weight. So he gave her already the jewelry. I mean, he already decided that this is the one before even asking who she was. And then he said in verse 23, whose daughter are you? pray tell me, is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? So it's a very interesting thing the commentaries discuss. He seemed to go out of order. He first offered her all the jewelry, and then said, by the way, who are you? What's your name? He should have said, who are you? And then figured out, oh, it's Avram's family. Let me give you the jewelry. So Rashi says, well, this shows Eliezer's great trust in God. He saw that everything he had davened for happened. He said, I don't need to know anything else. This is for sure her. And because he trusted in God so much, that God's going to lead him to the right girl, before he even asked about her family, he said, okay, you're the one. Take the jewelry. Now let's talk. So that was his trust in God. Others say that really Avram did not require the girl to be from his family. As long as she was from his homeland, that was good enough. And therefore, she was from his homeland, so he didn't need to ask her any further questions at the moment. So two ways to look at it. But he knew this was the one. And he contemplated her actions. The actions, again, speak louder than words. And now he asks her, Basmiat, to know who is your father, who is your mother, where are you from? And then it turns out, not just is this a girl with great mitos from Avram's hometown, this is actually Avram's family. She said, I am the daughter of Besuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nachor. I mean, this is Avraham's great niece. And she said to him, even straw and feed is plentiful with us, as well as a place to lodge. And she said, don't worry, come back to my house. And again, he asks, Rashi points out, the Hebrew says, Makom Lalin, a place to spend one night. And she says, Lalum, which means to lodge on a long-term basis, meaning she offered more than he asked for again. He said, I need a place to spend the night. She said, come stay as long as you want. So there's also her chesed going above and beyond. Look at verse 26. So the man bowed low and prostrated himself to Hashem. He said, blessed is Hashem, God of my master Avraham, who has not withheld his kindness and truth from my master. As for me, Hashem has guided me on the way to the house of my master's brothers. So Eliezer sees the hand of God in this entire story, and he bows down to Hashem, shows his gratitude. And that's how it ends. So Eliezer understands it's all about Hashem guiding you in the right direction. So he starts off the entire mission with a prayer to Hashem. And when he completes his mission, he offers things to Hashem. Which in life is what we should do. You know, when we set out on a task, davening, please help me succeed, is the proper thing to do. And we do succeed, thanking Hashem for what we did is also the proper thing to do. That should be the bookends of anything we do in life. Those are the two bookends that we should have. So we see here, again, there's a lot more to the story. It continues on, the actual marriage and how he deals with her parents. But the point is that we see Rivka's great midos coming out through her reaction to Eliezer. Meaning, sometimes you don't need to know a person that well to see what they're all about. When you can see a few things they do and understand how sincere, how real, compassionate, how kind they are, it tells you a lot about a person. Rivka Aminu stands as somebody who fits into Avraham's family because she upheld the ideas of chesed in a very, very powerful way, again, which is seen very clearly in the story. So this became, again, the story continues that he has to go and deal with her parents. Finally, they all agree that she should marry Yitzchak. He takes her back, and they get married, and she moves, basically steps into Sarah's role as the next of the Amahos, the matriarchs of Klal Yisrael. Okay.